The mental health crisis that faces police every day. Local officers speak out. And diversity, equity, and inclusion under a different name in the cities. When is DEI not DEI? One school in the cities is looking at diversity, equity, inclusion in a different way. But first, the front lines of mental health. All too often, those who fall through the cracks end up facing law enforcement. In the cities, police agencies say the increase in mental health calls is creating a greater risk for police and society, not to mention those who are suffering the illness. Bettendorf Police Chief Doug Scott is part of a coalition of law enforcement agencies seeking change, and he joined us to talk about the need and the possible solutions. You really want state help for, and I want to get this right, short-term mental health support is what it's called. We're talking about people that literally are falling through the cracks, that they may take themselves off their medicines, and they become, as you're pointing, not only a threat to themselves, but also to officers and to society as well. What made you say that we really need to address this at the state level to give local law enforcement some help?
Well, as you mentioned, with local law enforcement, we aren't the mental health care workers. We're not trained in that space. So we are seeing...
You're becoming more trained in that space.
We are spending a lot more time in that space. So we're seeing a kind of cycle that occurs where... people who are mentally ill and are struggling aren't getting the longer-term care that they need, and it's causing no real place for us as first responders in law enforcement to be able to get them the help and that sustainment. They either go to the emergency room or they end up going to the jail, and neither one of those is really where they need the assistance from, in my opinion. I think that they need some intervention, some management to help get them leveled out so that they can participate again back at the level that is best for all of society.
You have been in contact with state lawmakers. I mean, are you hopeful something can be... there is no real easy solution. And mental health issues have been at the forefront of the Iowa legislature over the past few years, whether it's the closing of state institutions or the reallocations of how counties deal with it. But on the ground, you're seeing it firsthand. What is going on right now in Iowa is not working?
Yeah, I think we have a lot of room to improve. I think there's been, last year, I believe the legislators started some reallocation of the way funds were moving for healthcare throughout the state. And so, you know, we're in our first year. We have to understand it's going to take a little bit of time. It was a transition. You know, we had, you know, a decade ago, we had some closings of some longer-term institutions that were helpful for people to get stabilized, and those no longer exist. And more of that burden's falling on your police, your fire, your emergency room staff, your jails, and things like that to solve this problem, this challenge that all of us are facing in one way or another. And I'm looking to try to bring some awareness and see if we can find some solutions to help out.
Bring some awareness with an incredible statistic, $7 million in 5 years on just 17 individuals is what was being cited, basically $84,234 per person. That shows, because we're talking about 17 individuals, that it's a small group of people in this particular instance, but it is a huge amount of money.
That is true. We have we call that like a high utilizer, so we understand that we have some high utilizers of that come through the system, and they keep getting recycled back through the system because they're not able to get the help they need to break out of that.
And what brings them into the system in the first place? Is it like a disturbance in a house?
One multitude of ways, yeah. Right? It's it can be a disturbance. It can be family members calling in a domestic situation. It can be somebody inside a store that maybe they steal something and don't even really realize they're stealing it. They're putting it in pocket and leaving because of whatever's going on in their sense of reality. It can be, some of this has other dependency issues, whether it's drug or alcohol that gets involved in this as well to help them feel like they're medicating through their challenges. It can be just a lot of different ways. It can be a disturbance in an emergency room where they sought care, but because the emergency room wasn't able to handle it, they need them to be removed, and then they're back under the into the police department because maybe they assaulted a nurse or a doctor, or somebody that was supposed to help them, and now we're back into the jail faction of this, and then that will end up moving them back out onto the street, which then will lead to them having another encounter with first responders in some capacity, will land them back in the emergency room or back into the jail or something like that. So it's that cycle that just keeps going and going.
And we've seen Davenport saw an almost 300, this is a huge number. Davenport Police seeing almost a 300% increase in mental health calls from 2020 to 2024. Have you seen a similar increase in mental health calls?
We are seeing a larger amount of calls. I wouldn't say we've seen it to their level. I'm not quite sure how. We haven't gotten into the data that deep, so I don't really want to speak to it too much. But we definitely, there's a lot more of interaction, it seems like, on a daily basis, where it's a nonviolent, non-criminal disturbance that's created where law enforcement's trying to find a solution, whether it's a homelessness situation or we can't seem to find them the support that they need because it's non-voluntary. We have a lot of voluntary services in the Quad Cities, but if you're of the frame of mind that you're not looking for voluntary services and you're not able to get yourself the transportation or to get the medication that you need and sustain that medication and that treatment plan, then we're continuing to kick the can down the road.
Well, and there's people that are going to just say, well, just put them away. You know, just get them out of society. And as you were pointing out, is that, I mean, as far as commitment operations go, people have a lot of rights. I mean, if you don't want to get mental health services, in some cases, if not many cases, you don't have to have it. So it does become this cycle for you. And as you were saying earlier, you alluded to the fact that this has a high cost, not only monetarily, but also a bit of a threat, let's say, to police, to families, and perhaps to society itself.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you're dealing with an unknown situation or people of an irrational mind, there's always going to be an escalation that could go for the worst. And that's, we want to avoid that significantly. You know, we're not here to try to use any kind of force on someone because their mental faculties aren't based in the reality of what's occurring in front of them. You know, so we want to try to find those solutions on the front end so that we can de-escalate those situations, avoid that crisis, help them be able to live, you know, a life avoiding law enforcement in a negative sense.
Let's move on from there because interactions between police and society. I mean, we're seeing police stuck in the middle of ICE investigations, where you have people that are protesting or people that are trying to document these incidents. You struck me when you mentioned, and the real word is de-escalation. How much training is going into that these days? Because it seems like police have got to be able to be masters of de-escalation more now than before.
Police have to be the masters of a lot of things, or at least that's the expectation today, right? We're talking about mental health response on one. Now we're talking about de-escalation of maybe arrests or things in the community that maybe be going on that somebody doesn't care about. It's also the people who are responding, you know, into your schools to help out or their homes to deal with children. Mm-hmm. And then we have the family dynamics and domestic situations, and then, yeah, so we're...
Which is among the most dangerous for police to get involved in.
They very much are. So there's definitely a lot there, and from just an overall safety standpoint, it's imperative for everybody to try to be the best you can be with the tools that you were given or provided. So we spend time on training annually. We talk about it internally. And de-escalation can look like a lot of different things. De-escalation may be a tone of voice. It may also be just distance or when we even approach something. Maybe we don't approach it right away, you know, and that may cause people to question, well, the police need to get in there and deal with that. Well, maybe sometimes the best is spacing and time and a better assessment of what actually is the issue if someone's life is not in danger, right? So, it's a frequent conversation. It's trying to figure out what tools you have at your disposal, trying to navigate through the unknown and trying to make the best outcomes possible whenever we can.
Over the last year, I believe you had two officers that were injured responding to a domestic incident involving, I believe, a knife was back then. The danger is out there.
Yes, they were both shot.
I'm sorry, thank you.
Yeah, and it was a domestic between a male and a female in a basement of a residence, and also imbibed a knife as well as firearms. And then when the officers engaged, they were shot.
The officers are doing well now?
They are. They're back. They're back on the street. They needed to heal up and take a little bit of time, but I couldn't be more impressed with their resiliency and their ability to navigate that traumatic experience and then come back not only with that and share their experience, but also help make the department stronger and their day-to-day job of coming in and going back and dealing with similar calls is just outstanding to me.
I want to talk a little bit about when you're talking about some of the calls that are coming in. For a while, the real big problem was, of course, people stealing cars, generally juveniles stealing cars. And I know that you've also had to deal with a lot of vandalism and car break-ins these days. Is this cyclical? Is this like a rides a wave? I mean, are you still having these same problems and tends to be the same people?
I do think it's somewhat cyclical. I think, we were in COVID. We had a lot of issues going on politically across the country. We saw a huge uptick in juvenile crime, and juveniles were running all through the Quad Cities. Even though we have a lot of cities here, we're one community. The bridges really don't stop anybody from traversing wherever they want to go and doing what it is they want to do in those locations. So this was really impacting all of us. A car would get stolen in Davenport, and then it would be used in a crime in Rock Island, then it would be used in a crime or to steal another car and in Bettendorf, and we were just kind of moving it around. So with the use of partnerships through all of us, family resources, violence initiatives in the schools, utilizing license plate reader technology, mm-hmm. Cameras, we were able to really start to hold people accountable, make cases on that. And then it eventually has slowed itself down. And I think a lot of it has been through those processes and then back through into either juvenile courts or adjudication to adult court. And then people have decided it's not worth their time anymore to keep doing those crimes.
Because there was concern that I shouldn't paint a picture this broad. A lot of it was these kids. And then the kids would get a slap on the wrist, and then they were back out doing this. And it had to be frustrating for a police officer. But it just seemed to have been, I guess it was somewhat COVID-related, it just seemed to be a big issue for about a year and a half to 2 years.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it was a big spike into that 2021 timeframe, and then it's just been slowly we've been able to keep working it down to the levels that we're seeing today. And I think we're well over 50% reductions in both theft from vehicles as well as stolen vehicles.
You recently brought back looking for more tips for the David McAllister case, missing since 2017. You've got cold cases, and because of TV shows, it really sparks the public's interest. How do you continue an investigation when the leads are kind of drying up?
Well, it gets to be a real challenge, and some of the biggest way really is keep reaching back out to the public,
right.
To keep trying to reach somebody that knows something that hasn't come forward yet. We try to take advantage of opportunities that come along of maybe we knew somebody who knew him at that time and circling back around with them and trying to get them to come forward with maybe more information or things that they could point us in another direction or give us another lead. We've worked very hand in hand with the family, tried to assist with anything that we can, from bringing dogs out and doing field searches to excavating basements to you name it, we've tried to do it. There's really a gap of where he was last seen and then what happens next and who he was with at the time. And we have not been able to fill that in. So we want to continue to bring awareness. We want to continue to encourage anybody who knows something, even if they just heard something, to bring it forward. We hope that he's still alive and well and has just chosen not to reach out to his family, but his family's definitely suffering and they're very concerned about what this could be. It's been coming up on a year or on 10 years.
Yeah.
And so, we would like to be able to get down to the bottom of this.
Well, and it kind of underlines the fact that the case doesn't close.
Correct.
Yeah. And you look also, across the river to Trudy Appleby, which of course is the disappearance that was back in 1996. And a lot of times police do have a lot of the information. You just need the right information in order to create a prosecution. If I'm not saying David McAllister is necessarily a crime in any way, but cases such as that, you're still working them. you may have far more knowledge than the public has. You're just looking for those extra keys that allow you to prosecute?
Yeah, anything that comes in is going to be an investigative opportunity, and then you're going to use that to direct you where you can. You know, we have quite a few systems out there across the country, from DNA analysis, to just record sharing and things. So if we can come across something that can then lead us to something else, just like you said, with the Trudy Appleby, all of a sudden you can figure out, okay, what did this look like, and right. Then what opportunities do we have to solve this?
Last piece of the puzzle. Almost a year as chief, how's it been going, and what initiatives are you hoping for this coming year?
Yeah, no, it's been fast, it's been quick and furious. There's been ups and downs, as you can imagine. It's we've definitely hit the ground running. We're looking forward to the new police department build. We're looking fall of 27 should be move-in ready. So we're excited about that. We're kind of in a planning phase right now, making sure the offices and the layouts and everything are accounted for, and that it's going to work well for all the officers and all the employees of the department. We're working through an accreditation process right now. It would be the first time the department's had an accreditation through the Iowa Law Enforcement accreditation program. So we're hoping to have that wrapped up before the end of the spring. We're always recruiting. We're always trying to hire. So if you know anybody, send them our way. It's a lengthy process from the time you put your application in to the day you get hired, and the 16 weeks at the academy and the 14 plus weeks of field training on the streets with a partner mentoring you along the way, and then finally getting out there on your own. So it's about a year process. So we're always trying to find ways to reach people that who can serve their community and be part of the team. There's never a shortage of work. That's for sure. There's always something that can be done.
Our thanks to Bettendorf Police Chief Doug Scott. Spring has sprung, and not a moment too soon, right? We know there's cold weather to come, but there's also light at the end of the tunnel at this point. And we also know there's some great events and programs you may want to put on your calendar right now. So here's Visit Quad Cities.
Check out the things to do this week in the Quad Cities. Explore downtown Moline and hunt for eggs hidden at participating businesses. Snap a photo and submit it for a chance to win prizes. Next, enjoy a musical celebration of female country music stars. Check out Honky Tonk Angels at Circa 21 Dinner Playhouse. Then, every Wednesday, you can experience an open mic night. Show off your comedy, music, poetry, interpretive dance, the list goes on. Next, Daniel Tosh, comedian, host, writer, and producer, will be taking the Adler stage. Finally, experience Cage Aggression, March to Glory. This is a premier MMA experience right in the QC. For more events like these, check out our events calendar at visitquadcities.com.
DEI programs are being dismantled nationwide. Iowa has aggressively removed diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at its three state universities. But Augustana College is bucking the trend. Its DEI coordinator is now the vice president of culture and connectivity. Now, is that just a name change, or is it something more? We talked about DEI initiatives with Augustana's Dr. Gauri Patali. So diversity, equity, and inclusion seems like something that we all want to reach, but DEI now has gotten a very dirty reputation. That's got to be frustrating for a person like you.
Well, I think that there's a misconception that diversity, equity, and inclusion work is for specific people. And I would like to clarify that the work that I've always done has been focused on student success and student belonging. And it doesn't matter what background the student comes from. What we care about is that they feel like they are a part of our institution and that they can thrive and they can succeed. A lot of the work that I do, primarily now as the Vice President for Culture and Connection, is to ensure that our students are academically, socially ready to be able to do collaborative work across differences, across identity, lived experience, even perspective differences, so that they are able to have a beautiful collaboration and lead teams and lift up people. So I think that it is a misconception that the work is for a specific population. It never was, and it never has been. But our evolution at Augustana College to Culture and Connection really allows us to thread this into the fabric of the institution in a meaningful way. When our office began as the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, it was at a specific point of time in our institutional history. Subsequently, our student population has evolved, our campus community has evolved, and we have recognized that this work needs to be something that we thread through the institution and work that allows everyone to be able to engage with the great diversity that we have on our own campus so that they can engage with it, they can learn from it, and they can continue to uplift all of their communities in a meaningful way.
Now, you are, of course, at Augustana in mm-hmm. Illinois. And Augustana, this has been a part of Augustana since the day it was founded. It's always been a part
yes.
of mission. I know that's something that the school and you in particular are proud of course.
Yes.
But you see across the river in Iowa where DEI or diversity, equity, and inclusion programs are seriously under attack, particularly in the public school system. Does that give you pause? I mean, does that, I don't know, how does that impact you as a person who is in Illinois and at Augustana looking at what's going on just across the river?
You know, it's very hard. Every institution makes the decisions that they feel are right for them. And it's not on us or me to be able to say what direction they should go into. For us at Augustana, this was a really great time for us to look at our structures, to look at our systems, and to also go back to our mission, our Lutheran values of grace, dignity, and loving our neighbors. Those values continue to always undergird all of the work that we're doing. So with the launch of the Office of Vice President for Culture and Connection, we really aligned with that missional work, and we ensured that we can make good on our promise to graduate students who can be leaders in a global and an interconnected world.
Critics, as you know, say that it's indoctrination. You would say, I'll let you say it.
I want to be clear in saying that we never tell students or anyone in our community what to think. All we do is provide them with the skills of critical thinking, and we teach them how to think, not what to think. And that, I think, is key to understand about any higher education institution. Our job is to provide our students with the skills to be able to think critically. What answers they reach is all up to them. We merely give them the tools to do that. So that is my perspective of how academia and the work that we do allows our students at our institutions to flourish and to be able to go out there. Because when you think about it, when you tell someone what to think, they are lost when they don't know what the answer is and they need to come back to you. We want our students to graduate and continue to thrive. For that, they need the skills to know how to think. So when they graduate and when they come across any kind of situation that is confusing, scary, even completely lost at times, they have the skills that they can rely on to think about, how can I think about this in a way that allows me to get multiple perspectives and find my answer?
And I wonder, because I think of my experience and as a white male, much different than a minority student, and I would think DEI and particularly the college classroom for me, is it taught you that there are different cultures, and it actually taught me a little more empathy. Mm-hmm. Is that a key? Is for like the white male or the white female to just better understand the world around them and to better understand other people and their backgrounds?
I think we live in a very global and a very interconnected world today, and there's a beautiful term by a writer called Michelle Mijung Kim. I love that term. It's called Oppression Olympics. And we are not here to tell anyone what their experience is. People always have hardships in their lives. People always work hard, and whatever results they get, they have put energy and time into. Our job is not to tell them that you are an X person and therefore this is your experience. It's so antithetical to how we teach in Augustana College, in higher education in general. So our hopes are that people will get exposed to people who are from different cultures and that we can help them understand that everybody is a human, everybody deserves dignity. And I think that when people deeply disagree with each other, more often than not, we tend to just shy away from that difference. We teach students how to engage with that difference, how to understand that the opinion is not the person, how to be able to see the humanity of the person, and to be able to then talk about, hey, we disagree on this. Let's talk a little more about why and how we came to this opinion separately, and also not to shift or change anyone's perspective, but to hold that difference, to sit in that difference and disagreement, and to still respect each other.
It's important in the college culture to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. What do you think your role is in the greater community then? Because Augustana, of course, tries to lead by example.
Yes, absolutely. We believe it's really important for us to be able to empower and to also be able to affect the community around us in a positive way. Now think about students who graduate and employees from our institution who engage and live in and around Quad Cities. When you have those skills, you're going to model them. That doesn't mean the person in front of you may know how to be able to do that, but it's a great way to lead by example, as you said, rightly so, right? Our students, when they graduate and when they join and become part of the larger broad Quad Cities community, are able to have those skills that they are able to share, which only serves our community better.
Dr. Gauri Patoli, the Vice President for Culture and Connectivity at Augustana College. 250 years ago, it took a spark to create a nation. As America marks 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, we look at what spark people in the cities have that's helped make our area a better place to live. And we asked Mercer County farmer Jeff Kerwin about his civic spark and what led him to be a district director for the Illinois Farm Bureau Board.
Farming was something that I was instilled as a young child. I grew up and that's all I wanted to do was farm. I can remember my mom telling, you know, every time I wanted to come back to the farm, she'd be like, no, you've got to go get an education. But it was always in my heart. And I think agriculture has that little spark about coming back to the farm or tending the land. And I think that's what makes us unique and special. I've taken care of the land like my grandfather took care of the land. It's a legacy. And I think that's a huge driver for American agriculture, is the legacy that we both create and that we're leaving behind for our next generation.
Our thanks to Illinois Farm Bureau District Director Jeff Kerwin. On the air, on the radio, on the web, on your mobile device, and streaming on your computer, thanks for taking some time to join us as we talk about the issues on the cities.